In the news.
Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Government. I'm Eric McDaniel.
And I'm Jim Henson.
All right, so we have another week of primaries. So yesterday we had the New Hampshire primaries. So we're going to go over real quick about the rundown. So if you look at the Democratic side, where basically it became a two-person race after Governor O'Malley dropped out, you see basically what's going to happen to me if I forget Valentine's Day this year. It was a beatdown. Bernie Sanders, 60%, Hillary Clinton, about 38%. So this is clearly, you know, everybody thought Bernie was going to win, but they didn't think he was going to win by this much. It's a clear win for Bernie. Now, if we move to the Republican side, what we see is, again, it's still have a lot more individuals involved, but it's a clear win for Trump. So he has received the plurality, followed by John Kasich, Ted Cruz, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie, Carly Fiorina, and Ben Carson. And be truthful, the way the media coverage is gone, you would forget Fiorina and Carson were in the race. And I think you will forget shortly. We were just trying to remember, I forgot his name already again.
Herman Cain.
I remember his short period during the 2012 election.
But you mean that in a very nice way.
In a very nice way, yes. As nice as I can be. Now, if we move on to basically the breakdown of delegates, we kind of see what's going on within the race. So we see Bernie came out with, Senator Sanders came out with, 13. Now he has 34. Hillary Clinton, or former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, has come out with 9 with 32. So in terms of these votes, Sanders has a lead, but the problem is the Democrats have super delegates.
Right, and so that if you look at the overall delegate count, which we're not going to get into at this point, Hillary Clinton's actually very far ahead. And the super delegates, in summary, are party leaders that aren't elected. They basically choose who they are going to align with, and they tend to be elected officials in the states, things like this. And we'll go back and talk about the superdelegates. But I think moving forward, we're going to see a lot of contesting for those superdelegates as time goes on. Now, the dynamics in this race get more and more interesting, don't they? I mean, you know, that was a thumping.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a serious thumping. And that actually overperformed actually what we thought. And the week going in there, the poll average had Sanders ahead, I think, depending on what you looked at and how you weighted the polls, ahead by 15 or so. I mean, that is a big margin and certainly very unhappy times at Clinton political headquarters. Now, there are a couple of dynamics here now as we look forward to how this race is going to shake out. Now, one of them is race. Now, there's an expectation that Sanders will cool off and Clinton will do better as we go into the southern states. First, South Carolina. We have South Carolina and Nevada, and Nevada still coming up. But on Super Tuesday, which is March 1st, we're going to have a whole batch of states, including several southern states, including Texas. Now, one of the big expectations here is that Sanders will not do as well among ethnic minority voters that are a big share of Democratic Party votes in the South. So what do you think, Eric? I mean, do you think because Sanders has been doing so well, Clinton has been underperforming, that we're going to get minorities, particularly African-Americans, taking another look at Bernie Sanders?
I think that is going to happen. There's been quite a bit of a discussion. If you look at editorials where elites have really been talking about taking another look at Bernie Sanders, specifically with his record regarding civil rights, I think one of the big things is his economic platform is very beneficial to minorities, because it's like a greater share of wealth distribution. And many of our arguments for minorities is it's not just an issue of civil rights, protecting my civil rights, but making sure that, you know, I'm not economically deprived. And so they're being hit in kind of in two different ways. I think Hillary Clinton can attach herself to Bill Clinton. It was this idea of being, look, I'm a trumpeter of minority values. You know, Bill Clinton was known as the first black president, you know, all that stuff. He played the saxophone, kissed black babies, things like that. But the problem he also has, problem you also run into is the welfare reform, which was highly racialized. That was under Clinton. And in many of the sentencing guidelines that we're talking about now, during the Clinton administration. So while Bill Clinton is able to trumpet his connection with the blacks, you can look at some of his policies and say some of them weren't that good. Now, economically, blacks did very well under Clinton. But there are some things where if we look back in time, we see it may not have worked out as well. There are some dark spots in that case, and not using a pun.
Yeah, I wasn't going to go there. But I do want to comment on how great it is that you worked in both trumpet and saxophone in that answer. Now, I think the trumpet thing does get to something a little bit serious, is that, you know, I think there's an essence in which, there's a way in which everybody has been assuming that Clinton kind of has these ethnic and racial minorities kind of locked up. But once you really look at how similar their positions really are, particularly on economic issues, that may or may not be the case. And in some ways, it almost suggests or hints at what Sanders has been saying about Clinton, that she is sort of the heir apparent rather than having earned what she gets. Now, another dynamic that's been interesting in the race leading up to the voting in New Hampshire was that late last week and over the weekend, there was a lot of media coverage and noise in the lines, I think, over how surrogates for Hillary Clinton, in particular, Madeleine Albright, the former Secretary of State, who has been a Clinton surrogate, and Gloria Steinem, kind of one of the iconic feminists in the country, were talking about how young women ought to be aligned with Hillary Clinton. So let's go ahead and we have a clip of Madeleine Albright. Let's play that and we'll talk about it a little bit.
We can tell our story about how we climb the ladder, and a lot of you younger women don't think you have to, it's been done. It's not done, and you have to help. Hillary Clinton will always be there for you, and just remember, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help each other.
Now, there are a lot of things one can say about that.
Yeah.
Obviously, it raised two things, a question of gender, and the fact that there's been a fight over women voters, obviously this age issue. And Hillary Clinton's response to that, I mean, she kind of doubles over in laughter. It's like, oh, you didn't, in a way that's very funny. But it really brought up, you know, a fairly serious issue about the presumptions of the Clinton campaign, particularly when it comes to young women.
Yeah, and this is an important thing. We're seeing a kind of a generational divide. Look at Madeleine Albright's statement. It's like, look, my generation fought for a lot of things, and there's still a fight going on. And you see the same thing going with black politics, of where you see the individuals who were connected to the civil rights movement basically making very strong arguments. Like, look, we fought for these things. You know, you're taking our work for granted. There's still more work to be done. You're benefiting from our gains. But not realizing, you know, there were a lot of losses and I think that still there's more work to be done. And the problem is when you play identity politics, things can always go wrong. I can think of, you know, somebody running for the Congress in Florida saying, if you don't vote for Christians, you're legislating sin. Like you make these strong statements, it's real easy to mobilize, but also mobilize your support, but also mobilize your opposition.
Yeah, I really suspect in this that the Clinton campaign was seeing something in the polling that they didn't like, because they deployed Madeleine Albright, and this was clearly, you know, what the point was to try to shore up Hillary Clinton's standing among women, and particularly young women. And it did, I think, backfire on them a bit and brought attention to the fact that there is a big generational difference. Now, Hillary Clinton has enjoyed an advantage among women. If we look at numbers in Texas from the November UT Texas Tribune poll, we see that, you know, Hillary Clinton did have, you know, about a 7 or 8 point edge over Bernie Sanders among women. But that's not huge. It's significant, but it's not huge. And I suspect once you start looking at where young women are, about 11% of women in that poll were undecided. We expect that. Women tend to register more undecided preferences at this stage of the game. But I think we also have to look at that 11% undecided and probably also assume that a lot of those voters are younger women. So it's a real interesting issue that I think is going to continue to unfold. Okay, so maybe now we should move and drill down into the Republicans, not literally, but drill down into that race, which has also gotten interesting, but in different kind of ways. The field is still crowded. The expectation going into New Hampshire was that there would be some clearing out of the field, that some of those medium candidates, when you look at how everybody ran, your John Kasich, your Jeb Bush, your Marco Rubio might clear out, that some of those guys might drop, and that there would become a clear, kind of more relatively mainstream contender. That hasn't happened. John Kasich came in second, and Kasich is a very interesting figure.
Yeah, so he is the governor of Ohio, and actually he is the most experienced of all the candidates. And one of the things that's been pointed out is when voters went to the New Hampshire polls, those who were really focused on experience were more likely to vote for Kasich than the others. Now, he's also been painted as kind of the Donald Trump of the establishment. He's been a bit testy.
Personality-wise.
Personality-wise. So he's been a bit testy with the media, also testy with the party. I think at one point he made a statement about lobbyists that if you're not going to get on the bus, we're going to run you over with the bus. So he's a very dynamic individual in that case. But in addition to this, he's also made some statements regarding basically economic distribution, protecting the poor, things of that nature. And so in many ways he's been somewhat anti-establishment, says that he's criticized the party and maybe gone against the party, but he is a clear establishment figure. He served in Congress for, I'm going to say, six terms. He was governor. He worked on Wall Street. So in many ways, he is an establishment candidate, but he has taken some slight anti-establishment stances from time to time.
And he also speaks to conventional wisdom in the sense that when he was governor and when he was in Congress, he represented Ohio, very important state in the general election. I think another interesting thing that when we look and think about where Kasich is and how Kasich came in second, the other person we were really watching going into this race was Marco Rubio, who had had a better than expected showing going into coming out in Iowa and then going into New Hampshire. Rubio then had a very bad debate, you know, lots of jokes about him being a robot or an android or some other artificial being because he kept repeating himself in that debate. Interesting, you know, thing about the chess game of politics and the way that these dynamics work, to switch metaphors, the person who really called Rubio out in that debate was Chris Christie. Chris Christie, as we saw, finished with less than 10%. Is probably done. Christie had banked a lot on doing well in New Hampshire. He did terribly, but he may well be best remembered for having really stymied Rubio's progress in New Hampshire. So that if we go back and we look at the delegate count, then it's still, you know, pretty mixed up and pretty muddy. Trump leads with the total delegates with 17, followed by Cruz with 10. Rubio has 7, still a contender, it would seem, but really feels like he's lost his momentum as we head into South Carolina.
Yeah, and you've got several fights going on. With we had the Rubio-Christie fight, which looks like it's over with because Christie's out, and we'll see how, but he may have created a mortal wound for Rubio, which will basically mean Rubio will fade out as time goes on. So I guess in many ways, if I'm not going to win, you ain't winning either. But then you also had the fight between Ted Cruz and Ben Carson. So Ben Carson it looks like for all intents and purposes, Ben Carson will be out of the race soon. Ted Cruz, who was gaining a lot of momentum, has been attacked for what Ben Carson referred to as his Washington values. So if you think of Ted Cruz talking about Donald Trump and his New York values, Ben Carson, who's really talked about being kind of anti-establishment, has tied Cruz into the establishment with that statement, particularly in terms of his kind of his tricks or statements he made about Carson dropping out of the race, which Carson says harmed him when he was running in Iowa. So Ted Cruz said, no, something that CNN said, we did nothing like that. We didn't do it at all. And so what's going on now is he's attacking Cruz, really along the idea of trustworthiness, and that he's just another Washington insider who'll do whatever it takes to win. And in many ways, the way you see people painting Hillary Clinton is the way people are kind of coming after Ted Cruz.
So that race will now move into Nevada and North Carolina. All the primaries will then go really get hotter come Super Tuesday, as we've said. There's been another interesting story in the news that we've been wanting to talk about, haven't been able to fit in from the campaigns, and that's what's going on in Flint, Michigan.
Yeah, so the Flint, Michigan crisis is a pretty big deal. It's been going on for more than a year. But to kind of help you understand what's going on, we have a real quick clip from CBS to explain the kind of the technical aspects of this.
Lead in drinking water should not exceed 15 parts per billion. In Flint, more than half of the homes sampled had over 1,000 ppb. The highest reading was 13,200, more than twice what the EPA considers toxic waste.
So you see, this is a very, really big issue in Flint. You're seeing a lot of congressional hearings, things like that. So let's kind of go through the timeline. The reason why this becomes such a big issue is because of kind of a slow response to this. So in April 2014, Flint switches its water supply from Detroit to the Flint River, mainly as a cost-saving measure. Flint, much like Detroit, was bankrupt. The state had taken over the city to try to get its funds together. Now, the problem using the Flint River is the Flint River is actually highly corrosive. So there was a GM plant that had been dumping a lot of chemicals into it. And really not until about the 70s or 80s when the EPA started enforcing things in the Flint River, it was highly corrosive. Now, while it's gone down, it's still highly corrosive. And so there were some concerns about switching to the Flint River. Now, what made this even worse is they switched to the Flint River without treating the water. And so there's a process that almost all water is treated. Even the water coming from Detroit is treated. They skipped this step, and this is what really caused all these problems. So basically, as soon as the water is coming in, people are complaining about the smell and the foul odor. And in fact, the GM plant that was in Flint stopped using municipal water because it said it was corroding the parts. So that's kind of the first warning. You have pediatricians coming out saying that they're seeing higher levels of lead in children. The EPA and Michigan officials test the water, but there's some controversy over how they test it. And eventually, there is a professor from the university, Virginia Tech, who did a study and found that, you know, the water from Flint was 19 times more corrosive than the Detroit water. And this is when basically everything exploded. So October 1st, you get the city officials urging residents to stop drinking the water. Before, they had a boil advisory saying there was bacteria, but you can't boil the lead out. And so you see them saying, look, we're not going to do this. We're going to switch to the Detroit water. But the problem was the water was so corrosive that even when they sent the Detroit water in, the lead was still leaching out. So lead is still in the water. So now you have to basically redo the entire water system in Flint, which is billions of dollars and can take a decade to complete. So January 5th, Governor Snyder declares a state of emergency, basically saying, look, we can't use the water in Flint. And this has been really the big argument. Like, you knew this was a problem a long time ago. Why did it take you so long to act? He asked for federal aid. That's when President Obama declares it a state of emergency and FEMA steps in. So again, this is really important. We're talking about the relationship between state and federal government, and also local and state government, is that in order for President Obama to declare a state of emergency in Flint, the governor had to make a request to the president. And so it's not that the president can all of a sudden step in. He had to wait for the request. When the request came through, that's when he did it. Then last week, you had a congressional hearing to find out who was at fault, and here's some of the outcome of that congressional hearing.
Today's often heated hearing was about the people who were not there as much as it was about the people who were there. Chairman Chaffetz kicked off today's session with strong words for Flint's former emergency manager, Darnell Early, who declined to testify.
We're calling on the U.S. Marshals to hunt him down and give him that subpoena.
Early is not the only person the committee wants to hear from. Democrats have urged leadership to invite Michigan Governor Rick Snyder to testify too.
Can anybody tell me why the governor of Michigan is not here today? Because he's hiding. That's what's happening.
Because he's hiding. I'm sorry, I couldn't help doing
that. No, I mean, it was basically like, everybody wanted to shout. The Republicans shouted at the EPA. The Democrats shouted at the Republican establishment. It was basically like, it's everybody's fault. And in fact, the Democrats are actually having a hearing today. They invited the governor, but he said, no, I'm actually working on the budget trying to fix the problem. Now, Darnell Early probably had really the worst excuse. He's now in Detroit. He's like, well, I'm working on fixing Detroit. I was like, you know, how about you stop fixing things? You may want to stop that. So would you see this kind of coming up? But this is a really important issue. One part of it is this idea of the environment, protecting the environment, but also the relationship between state, local, and federal. The idea is the state governments are protected by the Constitution from federal government intervention. Local governments are only protected so much as by the state constitution in terms of what can be done. And so in Michigan, the state can't take over a city if its finances are failing. You see this in Texas where the state is taking over school districts. And so the degree to which localities have powers to protect themselves from the state is limited by the state constitution, much like the state's ability to control what happens with the to control what their interaction with the federal government is dictated by the U.S. Constitution. And what you're seeing here is really federalism being played out, and really the trickiness of this in terms of the degree to which the federal government can step in to handle a dispute between the state and local government, as well as the degree to which the federal government can handle a crisis at the local level.
Yeah, I mean, there's these two overlays that really intersect. There's the politics of federalism, which have been so pronounced in terms of the relationships between local, federal, and state government in the last few years. And then there's also this issue of how the nation is really responding to some infrastructure issues that become more and more pressing within this kind of tangle of institutional and political factors. We see it here. There's been an ongoing methane gas leak in Southern California, the Porter Ranch area, which seems to be addressed very slowly, as you know, hundreds of pounds of methane are leaking into the environment every day. And then we've seen it even in Texas, where a couple of years ago, a year and a half or so ago, the city of Denton passed a city ordinance banning fracking in the city limits. That was ultimately overturned in the Texas legislature with a law that not only overturned that ban, but was going to make it much more difficult for such bans to be passed by other municipalities. And that was very much driven by the oil and gas industry nationally not wanting to see Denton set an example that would be followed around the country. So everything kind of converged in that case in Texas as well.
Yeah, and so what's going to happen is you're going to get a lot more stories about environmental pollution coming through after Flint. There are a lot more stories about lead in water and the need to basically shore up the American infrastructure and to some degree increase regulations on various manufacturers in terms of the pollutants that they're putting into the water. But that's for another time. We're going to sign off now. Remember, there's a lot going on in the news, so please keep yourself aware of it. Next week, we'll keep you up to date on what's happened with the latest in terms of the primaries. Well, we have a couple weeks before that, but enjoy your Valentine's Day and have a good week.
The Government 310 in the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Jim Henson and Eric McDaniel, and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.